Welcome to Divine Intimacy Radio, a co-production of EWTN Radio and SpiritualDirection.com, where we provide you with a spiritual haven of rest and explore the riches of the wisdom of the saints and the path to union with God.
Welcome to Divine Intimacy Radio. This is Dan and Jordan Burke. And Divine Intimacy Radio is your radio haven of rest.
Your hermitage of the heart.
Your monastery of the mind, where we lift our hearts and minds to heaven to draw upon the wisdom of the saints to help us to navigate the tumult of this life. And sometimes we deal with timely issues, right, in the church. And that's certainly what we're going to be doing today with our friend, Tim, our new friend, Tim Glemkowski. And if I messed up your name, Tim, I apologize. I'll take three lashes. Is that the right way to pronounce your last name?
Pretty good. Yeah, not bad.
It's great to have you with us. Tim is the CEO of the National Eucharistic Congress. What I said before we jumped into the show is that this is, in my opinion, the most important national Catholic effort in the church today. And it's been, we should have had Tim on a long time ago, but it just, I don't know what happened. Anyway, Tim and his wife Maggie live in Lakewood, Colorado with their four young children. Tim, it's great to have you with us to talk to us about this way that we are attempting to draw the hearts and minds of all Catholics to understand who it is that is in that little gold box in every one of our parishes.
No, it's such an honor. Yeah, I'm such a huge fan of the work you do, sort of lifting up, educating Catholics on the interior life. It was a spiritual theology class when I was 19 as a sophomore at Steubenville that really changed the way I pray and kind of view the Christian life. And so, yeah, to get to tie these things together, the Eucharistic revival, the sacramental economy of the church with sort of the growth and holiness we're all called to, I think it's going to be, I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Awesome. So I want to start out with a really super practical question. And I want you to treat us like five-year-olds because it's that important. I mean, in terms of simplicity, or as long as you need to go to explain it or whatever. So I'm in a diocese right now where I've heard absolutely zip about the National Eucharistic Congress, but my wife and I are flying to a diocese outside of the U.S., which is very ironic, to help with a Eucharistic revival in Trinidad, Tobago. Every faithful Catholic in the United States should know about this effort. Please tell us how it started, what it is, you know, what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And yeah, you're right. The mileage varies, right? And that's sort of intentional. The people who sort of helped to craft the whole initiative, it was supposed to be this grassroots invitation to the church, not like a top-down initiative. It was sort of like, this is who the church is in her heart. And so we're not going to tell you what to do. We're just going to invite everyone to, you know, with some sort of principles. But even, yeah, I mean, the international attention is crazy. Like the Pope in his last World Mission Day address talked about the Eucharistic revival.
And what that's kind of awesome.
Awesome. It's sort of a wild, I hear from people, someone in France was just contacting us about the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. Australia, I've heard from recently. So it's kind of wild around the world. Yeah, so the simplest story, right? Really what it is a story of kind of how God led the church to this moment. It's not really like, if you ask anybody, even the people who were there at the beginning, it's sort of maybe like the great things in the church was something that the bishops stumbled into, or maybe were called to providentially more than like this grand plan. The first prompt was a Pew Research study, you know, this group that does studies on belief in all religions, including Catholicism. And the Pew Research study, which was sort of awkwardly worded and not really accurate fully, we've kind of come to find, but we've redone the study. The first one said 30% of Catholics believe in the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, right? So it's like screeching truck tires, like what is going on in the church, right? So here's why, right? The Eucharist, like the theology of the church around the Eucharist, your listeners probably know, is that like the church is birthed out of the Eucharist, right? Like the Eucharistic reality confects the communion of the church. That's why we call it the source and the summit of the entire activity of the church. So for a very small, and I think that small percentage, studies we've done show it's probably closer to like 40, 45 of people who call themselves Catholic, right? If, you know, depending, but even we've done some studies that show like, even if you ask Catholics who report going to mass weekly or more, what they believe about the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, even that percentage is like lower than you'd think. It's like 60%,
right?
Which is kind of like weekly or more, you know? what it shows is a lot of things, a catechetical crisis, liturgical experiences that didn't sort of prioritize the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, people not having a personal encounter with Jesus that sort of helps faith in general in our culture, in our society is sort of a problem. And so all of this is to say, even I think most people anecdotally in their Sunday experience of Mass, like if you're kind of like feeling the tenor of, I've been in rooms, right, and in places prayed with Mother Teresa's sisters or my own experience in college at Steubenville, places where a higher percentage of the people in the Mass believe in what's happening on the altar, you can kind of feel it. There's like a difference of just sort of the tenor of the room. And I think most of us would say, looking at a normal parish in the United States, I travel around a lot, and something like a crisis of belief and reverence and love for Jesus in the Eucharist does not feel far off. And so this basically prompted the bishops to say, we want to respond. We want to take ownership for this. And so a lot of different planning and steps along the way, but it became this three-year initiative. We're in year two, almost at the start of year three right now, of this three-year just invitation to the church to say, hey, before we do anything else, there's a myriad of crises in the world and in the church and lots of different things we could tackle, but this is a broken spine in our church if we don't address it first. And so a calling back to all Catholics, either a deepening, if you believe, right, a more full kind of giving over of yourself to the mystery of Jesus in the Eucharist, or an initial faith, an initial encounter if you haven't had that yet. So for 3 years, that's just the invitation of the church. There were different phases and different audiences directed kind of for each year, leading to the Congress and the pilgrimage this summer, sort of this climactic moment that the year of mission comes from. But that's really what we're doing right now. So like you said, this is kind of the thing, like of all the things going on in the church right now, this is the one thing that our spiritual fathers are really calling us to be united around. And again, like you said, the local mileage can vary, but it has been exciting to see the way a lot of places have chosen to respond.
Yeah, I want to say this, and I know Jordan's got some thoughts brewing in his head, but we have a summit every year, an annual summit where we, you know, speak to various topics on the interior life. We canceled our summit this year because it fell around the time of the Eucharistic Congress, and we did not want to be a competition. We wanted to make sure anyone who thought, hey, we would be going to the summit, we were telling them, go to the Eucharistic Congress instead. And it's a very important Thank event you. For us. Yeah. So we believe in what you're doing. And I, you know, I would echo what you said. I mean, the data speaks for itself, but I appreciate you're using the word crisis, because if I could add some kind of sharp edges to that, and that is, if let's say 60% don't believe, or 40%, whatever the number is, it's a big number. And let's say if it's, you know, it's 50%, let's just use another number. When you go to the average parish, just about 100% of people go forward to receive. That means a huge percentage. Oh, and by the way, you could also just contrast that to how many go to confession in any parish. That means a huge percentage are committing the grave sin of sacrilege at a minimum. And a huge percentage don't believe de facto, whether they think this way or they say it, they don't believe their priest is any different than a Protestant minister, because nothing much happens up at that altar. They're just the one who presides over this ritual, but they don't confect the bread to become the body of Christ and the wine to become the blood of Christ through the sacrament. So this is truly a crisis, and why I think it's so important, why I'm so grateful for all of your hard work and that of, I think, Bishop Cousins,
yeah,
the head of the whole project. He's such a good bishop. Yeah, really. But anyway, so thank you for doing this, and please, everyone, pay attention. But Jordan, what's on your mind?
Yeah, the thing that popped into my head, so we work with a massive amount of, how many dioceses are we in now?
90 dioceses.
90 dioceses across the United States and then all over the place.
Yeah,
and we've done some internal studies talking with seminarians and what motivated them to become priests in the first place. Mm. For the life of me, I can't remember the statistic, but it was shocking to the point where those parishes that had, I believe it was perpetual adoration.
Eucharistic adoration, yeah.
Yeah, had a much higher amount of men entering into the priesthood. So it's not just this individual level of like, yes, we need to know and love Jesus in the Eucharist, and we need to know and understand what he does for us in the sacrifice. But for goodness sakes, this is where a lot of our priests are coming from.
Right.
And so if there's not this belief, if there's not this love, you know, no wonder we don't have as many priests as we should right now. I can't remember what dies, not to, but it was, I think it was New York last year.
Zero. Detroit, zero, yeah. Ordinations. Yeah. Right. You know, right. Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting point that you make, that is, even of the percentage of Catholics that can, you know, notionally assent to the doctrine, say like, I know what the church teaches and I can represent that.
Yeah.
The percentage of Catholics that have sort of made a real assent, or like what we would say, we have a living relationship with Jesus and Eucharist, is even smaller, because that is shown, yeah, in things like every Sunday mass attendance or frequent confession, or like you say, decisions to hand over my life in self-gift, in marriage, in having kids and then getting them baptized, and in giving my life to the church in a vocation like holy orders. And so I think you're right, where it's sort of this, like, if you focus on this and inviting more people to this relationship with Jesus and Eucharist, it raises a lot of shifts, which is why I think it's kind of a powerful place to focus right now. I'm a member of the millennial generation, right? And a quote, I don't know if this is, he's probably a controversial person to say on CatholicSpiritualDirection.com, but Karl Rahner, a quote that he said that I love, he had other things he said that I didn't love, was, in the coming age, the Christian will either be a mystic or he will cease to be a Christian at all. I think that's true. Like, unless people believe in something that's real, it's so hard to be Catholic today that if we're not convicted that this is actually real and true and worth it and relevant to my life, then we're not going to give our lives to it. And that's for me, 18 years old, and I encountered Jesus in the Eucharist in adoration, and it changed everything, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I would be, I'd imagine, particularly my generation and younger, but you know, yeah, and priests and people who are getting married, and like, there's probably, the percentage is likely much, much higher, because if they didn't, they're already gone. They left, you know, 20 years ago.
Amen. You know, just back to Rahner, even a broken clock is right twice a day.
That's right.
Yeah. And he was dead right in that quote. And but when we come back from the break, we're going to continue talking with Tim Glimkowski about the National Eucharistic Congress, which is very important to the life of faith in the church and the life of every Catholic's faith. So when we get back, what I want to jump into is, what do you hope are the outcomes of this Congress? Maybe revisit that quote, because I think there's something there that I really wish every Catholic could be confronted with, which is the idea that we're called to have, to come to union with God, which is, in modern language, is called a personal relationship. That's not a Protestant idea. That's a Catholic idea. Those Catholics who think it's Protestant, it's because they're ignorant of Catholic mystical tradition. The call to a personal relationship is required for salvation. Jesus told a good bunch of folks, hypothetically anyway, in the parable of the 10 virgins in the Matthew 7:22, that if they don't properly understand who they are and who he is and have that relationship right, and we're at our final judgment, we might hear, I don't know you, instead of, well done, good and faithful servant. So this is no small issue. When we get back, we'll continue to jump into this with Tim Glimkowski, CEO of National Eucharistic Congress. We'll be right back.
The beautiful fact that no suffering is wasted, that all suffering has a purpose, and to wrestle with the idea, which is that everything that happens in our lives is either willed or permitted by God. Okay, God, why would you permit these things? I know that you're a good father and you're a loving father. So there's something there. So I have to bridge this gap between your permission of my suffering to your love for me as a father. And Uniformity with God's Will, the book by St. Alphonsus Liguori, bridges that gap. And he explains, as only he can, because he's such a hard hitter, the reality that these are all moments of growth, of virtue, of, hey, your legs are weak, you're like a newborn deer, you can't stand on your own, we need to get you to stand on your own, you know, those sorts of things. Even desolation, you know, the day-to-day kind of the ebbs and flows of the spiritual life, those things are all permitted for a greater good, whatever that might be.
Check out the brand new updated version of Uniformity with God's Will, titled Finding Peace in the Storm, with commentary by Dan Burke.
Dan Jordan Burke, welcome back to Divine Intimacy Radio. We're with Tim Glemkowski, CEO of the National Eucharistic Congress. Eucharisticcongress.org is the website, eucharisticcongress.org. Jordan, what's up? What are you doing?
Yeah, so I, you know, as I've been listening to you talk about this and reading over all these different things and even watching out kind of on the periphery, it's very evident to me that there is a lot of love and care and attention. You know, this is the first Eucharistic Congress in the U.S. in nearly 50 years. So I was curious if you'd be willing to share more about your personal experience and your motivation as to why you're doing this.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So I'll try to tell maybe some of the quick details that are relevant. I'd started an apostolate in 2016 and then had gone working full time for that in 2017 and run that into COVID. And so COVID impacted a lot of apostolates, and mine was all on-site consulting and speaking and like evangelization and parish renewal. So I'd been offered a role at the Archdiocese of Denver to come work for Archbishop Aquila as his director of strategy. And through that, met Bishop Andrew Cousins. And Bishop Cousins invited me to be on the committee for evangelization. They have these lay consultants that just basically come in. We have three men, three women on the committee on evangelization, just speak into like the conversation the bishops are having around evangelization. Well, Bishop Cousins had been asked, I didn't know this, to run this Eucharistic Revival project through the committee. And so I got close to it quickly. And one of the reasons I'd been asked is a lot of my work was in like, you know, strategy and strategic planning and stuff. And so I facilitated the initial strategic planning of the Eucharistic Revival. And I have to be honest, at first I wasn't that stoked about it. It just, again, seemed like there's a lot of issues in the world and like the, you know, kind of intractable difficulties of the church and the advance of secularism. And I was like, is this really, you know, the answer to that? And then I came to see like God was really doing something in this church, like that God was actually saying, No, I'm inviting my church to my heart. Like in light of the all the things going on, like where I'm calling you first is in the midst of the confusion, the hurt, the brokenness, the disenchantment so many are experiencing, I'm calling you, you know, back into me, which felt so much like God to me. Like it sounded like the Father I've come to know. So the bishops in June 2021, they voted for Eucharistic Revival. November 2021, they voted to have a National Eucharistic Congress, the 10th National Eucharistic Congress, the first in 83 years. We'd had, as you mentioned, an international one in Philadelphia in 1976. And to sort of support this campaign and this effort, they were going to found an independent 501c3 with its own board of directors and hire an executive director and all this stuff. So I was watching the vote. And from my office at the Archdiocese of Denver, I'd flown back after the meetings, and the bishops voted 201-12 to have this moment, which is like 95% of bishops agreeing on such a complex thing. Pretty remarkable, agreeing on anything, let alone such a complex thing. So I really was like profoundly moved and felt called to it. So I had lunch with my wife that day, actually, like randomly on the calendar. And I remember telling her like, hey, I think I'm supposed to go help Bishop Cousins with this Eucharistic Revival thing. And she said, no, you're not. And so here I am 2 years later. So I've been working 2 years full time. We have 14 staff now in the organization. And really, it's almost like the best analogy, this is so crass, but the best analogy is almost like working for like a political campaign, except our candidate is Jesus in the Eucharist. Like it's very similar. Like we're trying to cast vision and get resources out and communicate clarity and kind of rally this grassroots sort of momentum around an idea or a cause. And so it's very complex in its own way. But a lot of my job's been, yeah, fundraising and you know, hiring staff and building the initiative. But I mean, the honor of a lifetime to get to actually help the church do the thing that's like most important for her to do. And so I very much so come to believe in the goodwill and the good sort of heart behind so much of this. And so, yeah, I ride pretty hard for the Eucharistic Revival for sure.
This is awesome.
Awesome. Now back to the question before Jordan just derailed us. What is your hope of the overall outcome? Like if you could, if there was a measurable of being a guy that's a strategy guy, my first book I wrote was on business and technology strategy. So I get it. What do you hope to be the outcome of all this work?
Yeah, we've had goals for each year. And, you know, certainly I think long-term some of the like numbers that we could identify is, I actually think some of these studies around like belief can be pretty easily, you know, sort of manipulated. I think it's more like, there are going to be statistics in the church that are going to show that more Catholics are making a gift of their life. And so I think those would be vocational decisions, you know, Sunday mass attendance, things like that, which show a real living relationship. I think for me at the heart of it is that is the Eucharistic pedagogy, right? Like what the Eucharist teaches the church is that Jesus in the Eucharist gives himself to me. When I encounter that gift, it invites me to know my identity in a new way. in light of that identity, I know how I'm called to live a life of self-gift and sacrifice, a Eucharistic life in a new way. And in that life of sacrifice always involves some fruitfulness, an inherent fruitfulness. I become that which I receive. And so to me, the percentage of Catholics in the United States, whatever it is, who have kind of gone all the way to living out the mission of Jesus in the Eucharist to be broken open in my own life for the life of the world, that percentage has to grow. And so however we identify what that percentage is, that's the real outcome. Is the only change that transformation we're going to see in the church, I'm convicted, is through the transformation of individual lives and saints. That's the logic of the gospel from the very beginning. Like, I change people, Jesus decided, and because of the changed people gathered around the sacramental economy, the world gets changed. And so that logic isn't any different today. It's the logic that's carried through the religious orders and the saints and the mystics. And so that really, to me, is the outcome of any authentically, you know, Catholic movement.
I love that. There's so many stories in our history of our faith as well that revolve around the Eucharist and revolve around when people get together. I'm thinking that there was a satanic convention, I believe it was in Arizona, and Bishop Olmsted said, no, we're not going to go protest it. We're going to all go get on our knees in front of the Eucharist and we're going to pray. And what happened? It shut down. You know, there was centuries ago, there was a plague. And what did they do? There was a Eucharistic procession, if I'm remembering correctly. And they did a Eucharistic procession around the city where the plague took place. Plague stopped. I love this idea of we need to be on our knees. We need to understand Jesus. We need to seek him in the Eucharist, because once we do that and it impacts us, everything else around us changes.
Yes. Yeah, we have these kneelers for the Congress. I just saw our proofs of these the other day. And like our, you know, like the foam kneelers that make it easier to kneel during mass and adoration in like a stadium kind of thing. And they say on them, revival starts here. And the whole idea is like revival starts on our knees. Wow. Yeah,
I love that.
You know, That's Dr. Awesome. Lillis, the co-founder of the Abel Institute, said, he's a spiritual theologian as far as his doctoral work. He says that every renewal of the church is preceded by a renewal of mental prayer, which is what we're talking about in relationship to the source and summit of our faith, in relationship to the Eucharist. I mean, there's no place better to do a mental prayer than in adoration. But I love that pew idea.
That's awesome. Yeah. Isn't that good?
Think of that?
That was like our graphic designers. They just we had an idea for this and we're like, that's unbelievable. And that's it. I think people even forget that the efficacy or fruitfulness of the sacramental encounters, like the dispositions of heart that we bring to them, impact how much it changes and transforms us in our experience of those things. And so I think there's some of these basic things that show, the deep connection between mental prayer and the like, if you wonder, right, why do more people go up every week and receive the living God and aren't transformed by that encounter? The disposition of heart is the answer.
Totally true. Maybe you should teach a class at the Avila Institute. Yeah. The Apostle Evia community, one of our sayings is all things for God begin before God on our knees, right? And when we begin before God on our knees, we rise with his wisdom, his insight, his consolation, his perspective, his energy, you know, and then we can go conquer the world. So this is what I want to know. Here's what I want to hear from you. So I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to say, yes, absolutely. And that is, will your efforts continue formally for the bishops after the 3 years is up?
Yeah, we've actually just recently, the last couple of months, been approved to do so.
Oh, wow. So you're very good at obedience. I appreciate that. Let the bishops know I appreciate their obedience as well.
But obedience to the Lord first, but yeah, to our good bishops in addition. Yeah, so our bishops advisory board and others spoke into a continued mission that this generational project of Eucharistic revival would continue through the Congress organization. There's going to be a new CEO who's going to step in and do that. Like, I told Bishop Cousins, I'm Sam Gamgee. I'm like, I'm here to help you get the ring in the mountain. And then I got to go back to the Shire. But there's a real energy behind it to continue.
Okay, so could I pitch you something in front of 100,000 or so people?
Sure.
I have a strong recommendation, and that is that you continue to aggressively measure the outcomes, because I believe in what you're doing, But as you know, as a strategy guy, what gets measured gets done. Mm. Just by the very nature of measurement, it affects the psyche of those being measured, and it tends to produce the results you want. But also so that the strategy can be adjusted, where it's, because there'll be things you're going to do that are going to be super effective, and some things you do that won't be all that effective. There'll be pockets where you're not even allowed to kneel, or practically not allowed to kneel before receiving communion, where they need to be broken open spiritually, and revival needs to occur at all levels. But the only way you're going to know that in the hub of the thing, which is where you sit now, is through measures. Not that measures, you know, can perfectly quantify a spiritual reality, which we've kind of been reviewing about relationship. But, and I'll also offer this, the Sophia Institute has an amazing tool called the Assessment for Religious Knowledge, ARK. And I bet if somebody from your office, Charlie McKinney is the president of Sophia, and he is a convert, he's on fire, loves the church, totally dedicated to the magisterium. Best young entrepreneur I know in the church. Maybe you're up with him as well. I love your spirit. But I bet they would work with you guys to help to get a tool in place where you could get some constant feedback. So that's my pitch. I don't know what you think.
I would love to see anything. I'd love anyone's feedback. If 100,000 people are watching. Yeah, what do you measure? So we have thoughts. I mean, we have like, here would be what you, because most people were saying, just keep watching the Pew study type thing, like how many people say they believe, and if it's 30 now, is it 40, you know, yeah, in 5 years. And I just think it's limited in some ways. I don't think it gets to the core of the issue. And so yeah, we have ideas of 3, 5, 10 year measurements, but I would also take I would love thoughts of anyone, Sophia Institute or anyone listening today too.
Awesome. Well, Tim, it's been great being with you. Our time is up. It feels like it should be 2 hours instead of a half hour. But really appreciate your work. We're praying for you. We're on your side, if you will. If there's anything else we can do to help publicize, we'll get this out to as many people as we can. Thank you for your good work. And thanks. Please express our appreciation to Bishop Cousins as well.
Will do. God bless.
Oh, I do the outro.
Now he's creating work for the editor.
Until next time, may the God of peace make you perfect in holiness. May he preserve you whole and entire, spirit, soul, and body, irreproachable at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ.
Amen.
Learn more about the interior life. Visit spiritualdirection.com. Divine Intimacy Radio is a co-production of EWTN Radio and spiritualdirection.com, and heard worldwide on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.